America Trends Podcast is part of the MHNR Network. MHNRnetwork.com.
What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends. I'm Larry Rifkin. When we pulled out of Afghanistan several months ago, what we saw disturbed many of us. It seemed chaotic and haphazard. Yet there is an argument to be made that a set of circumstances surrounding our withdrawal made this inevitable. We heard commentary about the war and its closure from military experts and commentators. I wanted to hear from someone who served and knew what sacrifice in Afghanistan really meant. Our guest today was not only deployed in Afghanistan, but lost a brother there as well. You may be surprised by his observations about the war and what was or was not accomplished during America's longest war. That's next on America Trends.
With us on America Trends is Scott DeLuzio, and he's written a book called Surviving Son. An Afghanistan war veteran reveals his nightmare of becoming a Gold Star brother. And it's a remarkable story. It truly is. And you lost your brother, Stephen. You were in the combat zone at that time. I mean, that had to be the most difficult circumstance that I can imagine.
It was. It was a very difficult situation to be in. And going through that, it just opened my eyes to the fact that we're not invincible. I went over there and almost, basically lying to myself, saying that, nothing bad is going to happen to me. Nothing bad is going to happen to my brother and stuff like that. But, because those things, they happen to other people. And then, I come to find out that we are those other people. Things can happen to us just as easily as it can to anybody else. So it was a very difficult situation.
Well, you served 6 years with the Army National Guard, and then that deployment in Afghanistan in 2010. How common was your experience as somebody who'd been in the National Guard, and then all of a sudden you're called up? Now, that's about 9 years into the war. You've got to give us your perspective, of course, since Afghanistan and the trail we've left behind in the recent period has gotten this back into our attention. And I think regrettably, and I'm going to say this to you, Scott, I think many Americans, perhaps including myself, really lost track of what was going on over there after a time.
Yeah, and I think it really is easy to lose track of something when it goes on for so long, and it almost just becomes commonplace that we are, deployed overseas, and we have troops over there, and it just becomes as common as, you wake up in the morning and, put your clothes on the way you do every morning. It just becomes something that is routine, and it just is something that is there. My experience as far as being a National Guard soldier who was deployed to Afghanistan and also Iraq, I was not deployed to Iraq, but as far as the experiences of National Guard, they were being deployed at a fairly regular pace. My brother and I both were in the National Guard. He was in the Vermont Army National Guard, and I was in the Connecticut Army National Guard. But our two units fell under the same brigade, and so that's why we were deployed at the same time, those two separate state National Guards. That's why we all went over there at the same time, because the whole brigade was being deployed. And there was several thousand soldiers in that deployment. And if I recall correctly, I believe our deployment was one of the larger deployments of National Guard troops since World War II. And so It was a fairly common experience to have that happen as far as the National Guard. But it's also fairly common, and I think there's a misconception amongst people. It was also fairly common to have sets of siblings deployed as well. My own company that I was in had several sets of brothers that were in the same company, and I know my brother's unit also had at least one set of brothers who were in the same unit. And so, it's not uncommon for a set of brothers to be in the same country at the same time. However, what is uncommon is the situation that I experienced where while we were both deployed the same combat zone at the same time, where one of us did not make it home. That has not happened very often, and I don't believe, and I could be incorrect on this, but from my research, I don't believe that there are any other sets of brothers who experienced the same circumstances that I did in Afghanistan.
I thought we had changed that policy about allowing siblings over in a war zone at the same time after the fighting Sullivans in World War II. I guess I'm mistaken.
Yeah, and there's not really a policy per se in terms of not having brothers being in the same deployment. It's sort of an unwritten rule where commanders will generally not have a set of brothers going out on the same mission. So should something happen to them, to that mission, then, one of the brothers would not be out on that same mission, typically. So that typically is what happens, although there's not a hard and fast rule on that. So, in extreme circumstances, they certainly could have the same, a set of brothers in the same firefight or mission or whatever the case may be.
I want to get back to your personal story as we move along, but I must bring it to the Uber story that's on everyone's mind about people who did go over, risked it all for us, and of course you being the surviving son and losing your brother. I've got to ask you, I saw in the Wall Street Journal the review about the time that we were leaving, and it said, "What went wrong?" And it's got all these headlines. Different people writing different pieces. Having won, we chose to lose. A mission doomed by contradictions. A war that Afghans were never allowed to own. From the start, a self-declared hurry to withdraw. A surreal gap between rhetoric and reality. When you hear those headlines, Scott, you could point to one and say, yeah, that I really get. But I'm just curious, how does it make you feel?
I think that a lot of things could have been done better. As far as there's one headline, I believe you said something about the Afghans were not allowed to own this war or something like that.
Right,
we
a
did
war
a lot
that
of training.
Afghans were never allowed to own.
Yeah, exactly. We did a lot of training with the Afghan army, and we tried to train them to do some of the same tactics and maneuvers and things like that we would do, and we tried very hard to get them up to speed. This is my own personal perspective, and other people I'm sure will have their perspective, and they may or may not agree with me on this one. But as far as I'm concerned, we did try to do this. The mission that I was on the day that my brother was killed, it was a joint mission with the Afghan army, and we were giving them the lead, and we said, you guys go out and you clear these houses, and we're here, almost, I think I make the analogy in the book Surviving Son of a driver's ed instructor, where you have that brake on the passenger side where you can pump the brakes if you need to if things get a little bit out of control. And I felt like we were sort of there as the driver's ed instructor, where should something get out of control and the Afghan army needed our help, we were there to support them, but we were giving them the lead. So as far as not allowing them to own it, I don't know what that article is specifically about and what they're referring to, but I know for a fact that we did try to train the Afghan army and tried to give them the lead on some of these missions as well. So, as far as that goes, I don't necessarily agree with that. What I do notice a lot of people saying is that these lives, including my brother's, were lost for nothing. It was a wasted effort over there. And, you know, I don't know, maybe some of those articles that you referred to are referring to that as well. But to me, it seems like a lot of those articles are just picking on all the negatives that went on over there. But we did a lot of good. You know, we took the fight over there to the enemy, and we prevented another 9/11 style attack here in the United States. For 20 years, we lived without planes falling out of the sky and crashing into buildings. And so I'm confident in saying that there are people walking this earth today because of what we did over there in Afghanistan, and that they are walking this earth because we were able to protect them here at home by taking the fight over there to the enemy. And not just Americans who are still around today, but there's also Afghans, you know, the people who didn't have to live under the oppressive Taliban rule for 20 years. You know, they are still around. You know, their children, their girls especially, were able to go to school for the first time ever. And, you know, I think that we gave them a little bit of freedom, and I think that that's something worth celebrating, you know, that we did some good over there, you know, and also over here by keeping that fight over there.
But let me ask you, if somebody says, well, we just delayed the inevitable with the Taliban, and we've given them now a lot of better buildings, infrastructure, educational classrooms, we have given women hope, but that hope may have been dashed in this recent period. What do you say to that? Do you think people there are better equipped now, as they look at the Taliban 20 years later, to decide what parts of that regime still make sense to them, if they ever did, and what they are going to redesign, or whether they have the confidence now to go forward and challenge some of the horrific acts that we've seen on the part of the Taliban?
Yeah, and again, I go back to something that I wrote about in the book, Surviving Son, that I use this analogy. My grandmother, she was diagnosed with cancer in 1968. And the doctors went in, they did their thing, they gave her the treatments, and she went into remission. And the cancer came back in the late 80s, about 1988 or so, is when the cancer came back, and it eventually took her life in 1989. But I would not say that the doctor's efforts back in the 60s, when she first went to the doctors to get this treatment, were a wasted effort, and that it was a futile effort because eventually she was going to die from this anyways. And I look at it the same situation as what happened over there in Afghanistan. You know, we went over there and we did some work, very similar to how the doctors did some work for my grandmother. And, you know, we allowed those people to live in freedom for those 20 years, you know, relative freedom. You know, it wasn't the same as what we have here. They did live in a war-torn country, and so it was not exactly, you know, the same thing. But, you know, they lived in relative peace for a period of time. And, you know, so I can't say that our efforts were all for nothing just because, you know, it was an inevitable, you know, that the Taliban would eventually come back into power and, you know, now they're better equipped and things like that. I mean, those things are, you know, above my pay grade, and I can't really, you know, speak to, you know, what the decisions were for, you know, how we withdrew and how all those, all that happened. But I look at it from the perspective of, you know, we did help those people, and we did what we could. And my hope is that we planted that seed of freedom in the back of their minds, and that hopefully that seed will grow and flourish, and they will want to make sure that they continue to have that bit of freedom, you know, and will fight back against the Taliban in the future.
What should we understand about what went wrong? Because, you know, Vietnam was a period that I'm old enough to remember. And I think we said, we're not going to do that again. And we recognize that counterinsurgency, asymmetrical war was not really what our conventional approach to war was about. We were still fighting World War II style, and of course the Viet Cong were not. And yet we've gotten into various situations that have been difficult to extricate ourselves with any kind of victory per se. And I've been reading where certain people feel that perhaps we didn't understand the tribal nature, the provincial and rural nature. We put all of our energies into Kabul and a central government, and that just wasn't going to work, and it never really permeated the entire countryside. I'm really curious, somebody who had boots on the ground, what did you sense about the way we understood exactly what we were trying to accomplish and whether it was in our image or theirs?
Yeah, you know, when I was over there, it was definitely a culture shock, seeing how the people lived. I've described it before as the houses that some of these people lived in were essentially mud huts. They took mud and they stacked it together to make bricks and put straw roofs on top of their houses, and they didn't have the running water or electricity like we have here, and it was very primitive living. And people around here in the United States, we don't really think of how people live like that. And the way that they associate with each other in a kind of tribal nature is foreign to us. It's foreign to our way of thinking. But one of the things, and I think this is true with any war, is we need to look back at what happened and do what we call in the Army an after-action review and take a look at some of the things that went well and some of the things that went bad and try to learn from these mistakes and try to, you know, learn from everything that took place. And that's part of the reason why I wrote the book Surviving Sun, was so that we'd have some sort of historical record. I know it's from my point of view, my perspective of things that happened in Afghanistan, but it's one piece of a bigger puzzle. And I think we need to look at all these pieces, and that's why I tell others it's important for them to tell their stories and you know, talk about their experiences, because it helps us to get a better understanding of the bigger picture, and it will help us in the long run to not make any of the same mistakes that we made in the past. So, you know, the better we understand history, the better off we'll be in the future. So I think that's, you know, from my perspective, I think we need to just have a better understanding overall of the big picture.
Scott DeLuzio is with us. And that bigger picture that eluded us, I'm just wondering what you think it was. In other words, when you hear at the end that it was a paper army, and you were just talking about how you were instructing them like a driver's ed, and yet they were real, they were there, they were equipped, ready to go. When you hear people say that the Afghan army melted away and was a paper army, what do you say to that?
Well, I do see from my experience over there, and this, again, is just my experience, that, you know, I other people may have had different experiences with the Afghan army, but I talk about this again in my book, how when we were trying to train them, it was during the time period of Ramadan, which to people who are unfamiliar with that, it's a time where Muslims fast. They don't eat or drink or anything like that during the day, during the daylight hours, and come sunset, then that's when they have a feast and they eat and everything. But when we were trying to train them during the day, which was really the only time that they practically could train, because they didn't have night vision goggles and the things like that we had. So when we tried to train them during the day, when the temperatures were soaring over 120 degrees and you were just baking out there, none of them really wanted to train. You know, they hadn't eaten anything or drank anything since the night before. And so their motivation, their willpower that was just not there. And now for me, it was the training that we did was largely during that time period. And so I can't say how they would be any other time of year. However, I did notice that they just were, they're more interested in finding some shade in a cool place to sit you know, just trying to hang out and not really expend too much energy, because quite frankly, they didn't have it to give. And so it was a difficult process for us to teach them and train them anything when they weren't all that interested in participating. You know, and so, you know, again, that was my experience over there with them. And, you know, as far as being a paper army and you know, falling apart, you know, after the Taliban took over, you know, I don't doubt that that's what happened, because, you know, they were, they did not have the same drive that we had. It didn't seem like, anyways. They weren't highly motivated. They weren't highly trained. They weren't well paid. They didn't have any of the things that were going to push them towards a successful outcome that maybe the American Army or some other foreign countries would have going for them, in terms
Scott,
of
did you,
the
did
training
you know
and the
that?
Discipline.
Did you know that in 2010, then you came back to the States? I'm wondering what you were thinking as we stayed on for another 10 years. I know that I had a guest on recently, Bing West, who co-wrote the book with Jim Mattis recently and has written many books about war and knows it so well from both his time in the field and in the major Pentagon positions. And he said that basically, we needed to stay 70 years to make any true impact, and that anything beyond the first couple of years when we got done what we basically wanted to do, which was to rout the Taliban, we didn't quite have a mission.
I think one of the things that we had working against us is that I don't know for sure that the definition of victory over there in Afghanistan, in that war, was well defined. It almost had a sense that it was a 1 year war fought 20 times, and we didn't. It almost like spinning our wheels, and we're doing almost the same thing over and over and over again. And I don't know that we had a clear definition of what success or victory would look like over there. And so, as far as like how we perceive this war and how everything went over there, I don't know how we can say, whether we won or lost, because I don't know that we had a definition of what that victory was. So it was, if we did, it wasn't very clear to me what that definition was. When you look back in history and look at previous wars, World War II, it was very clear what the definition of victory would be, by removing Hitler and freeing the people who were caught up in the Holocaust and everything like that. That was a very clear, aspect there. Whereas this war, it had a different feel to it. And I don't know that we really had a great definition of what victory was. We did our job. We did what we were paid to do and what we were told to do. We went out and we did that. And we had trust in our leadership that this was part of a bigger picture, that it was part of, a bigger effort that, maybe we don't understand every single aspect of what was going on over there, but we did understand that we were playing a part in that role. And so we didn't necessarily have conversations, philosophical discussions or, deep conversations about what that was. We were worried about the guys standing next to us and who we're fighting with. That's who we're concerned with. We figured that the rest of it would work its way out as long as we did what our jobs were, our missions were, and we succeeded in that. That's all we particularly cared about. And I wasn't a high-ranking, military official or anything like that. So that wasn't my job to be concerned with.
You came after the 2009 Afghan surge. A lot of historians or armchair pundits look back and say, we took our eye off the ball to some extent and gave so much resource after 2003 to Iraq that, in fact, we left Afghan behind. What do you say? Was there any sense of that on the ground?
On the ground, no. We didn't feel that way at all. We didn't notice anything. And quite frankly, that was my first time in the country, so I didn't really notice, any sort of change in, resources or things like that, because, I had nothing to compare it to. And so, I didn't really know that. Perhaps if you ask someone who was in Afghanistan in the early years and then later on, after all of that, maybe they would have had a different perspective. But as far as I'm concerned, we had what we needed, and we did our job.
Scott, that you've struggled with PTSD, and of course, there were 775,000 soldiers at different times deployed to Afghanistan. What is the cumulative effect, do you think, on all those who serve there? And what are you trying to do, I know, on your way back, not only writing this incredible book, but also really trying to help others?
I do talk about my struggle with PTSD in the book, Surviving Son, and I know there are a number of other people, you know, a lot of other people who struggle with it as well. You know, and what I hope is happening, and I see it happening, is I hope that we learn to have, like, open and honest conversations about mental health, PTSD, depression, anxiety, all the mental health issues that do affect the military community. And one of the things that I try to do on my podcast, the Drive On podcast, is to have these conversations with other veterans who are struggling with something or have struggled in the past, and how they've come through their struggle and how they've gotten through to the other side and beaten, you know, whatever it was that was bothering them. And there are so many different inspirational stories out there from people. And by hearing these stories, you know, other veterans who hear these stories, they may start to think, hey, you know what, there's hope for me yet. You know, if this person can do it, why can't I do it? And so that's why I try to share those stories on my podcast, but and also talk about my own struggles. And I know there's plenty of organizations out there, not just the VA, but there's nonprofits and other organizations who are doing things for veterans, oftentimes at free or very little cost. And they're out there trying to help veterans get the support that they need. And I think, you know, ultimately we need to, you know, as a country, just understand that there are some issues that are going to be, you know, difficult to deal with. And we need to help and support these people as they're coming back from their, time in the military and help them get back on their feet. Because we do a great job at training the soldiers to be soldiers and Marines and airmen and sailors and everyone too. But we also, don't do a great job at training them how to get back into civilian life and how to reintegrate back into the world. And so it's something I think we need to look at and maybe this is one of those lessons learned from this war. And maybe we can do a better job in the future.
Well, you now are an e-commerce software development business owner, but you didn't have the best return to civilian life. Your homecoming wasn't the hero's welcome that you deserved. What really happened there in that transition?
Yeah, so that transition, you know, and I talk about, again, I talk about this in the book, but when I found out about my brother being killed, within 20 minutes I was thrown into a firefight with the Taliban, and I was, after that, I was almost immediately taken off of that battlefield and started my journey back home. And so within 2 days of that, I was back home in the United States, and I had very little time to process any of the emotions, the grief, the anger, the you know, whatever you want to call it, but I was feeling a lot of different emotions. I never really had the time to process it. And I never picked up that grieving, in a healthy way again. And so it was a very big struggle, for me. And so when I came home, I came home to my brother's funeral, basically. You know, that's what I came home to. His funeral was on my wife and my, second anniversary, and so, our wedding anniversary. So it was like a big, struggle for me, when I came home, because there was nothing to celebrate. You know, usually you think of the soldiers coming home and you see all the pomp and circumstance and the parades and the American flags and the banners and everything like that. And there was none of that for me. And, you know, quite frankly, I didn't really want it, but you know, it's because of the circumstances that I found myself in. And it was a difficult, time to be coming home. And, you know, it was hard for me to learn how to, cope with these things a healthy way.
I know we talk about the 1% in America, the very wealthy, but there's another 1%. and that's the people like you, like your brother, who volunteer to fight our wars. And often these wars are inconclusive and far away. And as you say, we don't really know exactly what it is that victory might look like. What is it that you think we, the 99%, don't appreciate about the military and the service? And what would you like us to better understand?
I don't know, you know, in any individual, you know, what they do and don't understand, but I think America as a whole can do a better job at learning about what veterans deal with. You know, the PTSD, the guilt, the survivor's guilt, and the, you know, other things that, that people are dealing with. And there's a big disconnect between service members and veterans and the civilian population. I talked to one person on my podcast a few weeks ago, and he was saying how before he joined the military, he had a bunch of friends, you know, he grew up with high school and things like that. And after he got out of the military, he went back to his hometown and he went to go hang out with some of those people, and he found that they had nothing in common. They were best friends, you know, before, or very good friends before. And now it seemed like they had almost nothing in common with each other. You know, the way he talks, the way he jokes and things like that were off-putting to these people. And they were, you know, military people a lot of times will use dark humor to, you know, kind of cope with the situation. And, you know, it's a very off-putting thing to someone who isn't familiar with that. You know, so I think just hearing the stories, listening to what people have to say, reading books like mine, and there's countless others of people who have written books about their experiences, you know, learn about what veterans are going through and what they're dealing with. And my book, Surviving Son, and the podcast, Drive On Podcast, I think are good ways to start learning about some of the things that people have to deal with when they come home, and kind of bridge that gap between the civilian population and the rest of the military.
Just a few more questions. When you watched the withdrawal from Afghanistan, here it was, Afghanistan blanketing the news in a way that it hadn't for years and years. What did that conjure up for you?
At first, it was anger. You know, I was angry at how everything was happening, and then it was a sense of disbelief that I couldn't believe that, you know, what I was watching in the news was what I actually was seeing was true, and then it came to, you know, I talked about this earlier, but thinking about the good things that we did, and I started to go down that hole of saying, you know, everything we did over there was all for nothing. It was a wasted effort and all this and that. But then I also realized that, you know, had we not gone over there and done the things that we did, yeah, things suck right now for the people who are over there, but had we not done the things that we did, it would have sucked a lot more for other people. And it would have probably caused even more heartache here at home. And so I looked at some of the positive things. And so I really tried to avoid, that negativity and that negative thinking and thinking that we wasted our time and effort and money and resources and lives for nothing. It was something that I started to go down that hole, but I couldn't let myself go there. For my brother's sake, you know, I don't ever want to think that what he did was all in vain. It was for nothing. His sacrifice was meaningless. You know, I want to say that, you know, he did something that was bigger than himself. He served a cause that was bigger than himself. And he, yes, he sacrificed and he did lose his life, but, you know, I want to say that it was for a good cause, you know, and so that's where my mind goes.
In the closing moments, why don't you just reflect a little bit on Stephen so he's not forgotten?
Yeah, so, I mean, one of the things that I talked about in the book was how when I first came home, there were news vans lining up and down my parents' street, and it just got me so frustrated and so angry that these people would be jumping all over the chance to capitalize on, you know, someone's loss like this. And then it dawned on me that, you know, if we didn't tell my brother's story and we didn't say who he was and stuff. They were going to run a story one way or the other, and they may just interview someone in a grocery store parking lot, you know, and just get a soundbite so that they can have their 30 seconds on the news. But you know, for me, it's important to tell his story and talk about who he was. You know, he was a Yankees fan. He was a Boston Bruins fan. We would go up to Boston Bruins games all the time, and I'd talk about some funny stories from when we would go do that. And you know, he loved sports. He loved anything with a competition. It didn't even matter if it was just someone, you know, flipping over cards and, you know, trying to guess what card was coming up next. He loved any kind of competition, and he would compete with a good sense of humor, and you'd try to get under your skin, but you knew it was all, you know, from a place of love. And he would brighten up the room anytime he walked in, and he was just a fun and fun loving kind of guy. And I wish that everyone had the opportunity to have someone like that in their lives, because, you know, he really was, you know, a great way to brighten up anybody's day.
Well, as a Connecticut guy myself, I can understand that split allegiance. I don't think most people listening to this podcast understand how Connecticut is divided. Of course, for me, it's kind of easy. I'm a Knicks fan, and my dad was a San Francisco Giant fan because he was a New York Giant fan. So now I do San Francisco and New York. But Boston, I kind of have a good feeling for a lot of the Boston teams, too. But I've got to thank you so much for coming by on my podcast. And, Scott, the book's called Surviving Son, An Afghanistan War Veteran Reveals His Nightmare of Becoming a Gold Star Brother. And again, remind us where we can get your podcast.
Yeah, so the book you can get on Amazon or on survivingsonbook.com, or my podcast. You can subscribe to Drive On Podcast anywhere you listen to podcasts, or you can visit driveonpodcast.com.
Okay, so listen to both America Trends and Drive On, and that will do it. Hey, listen, I thank you so much for being with us. And again, thank you for your service and your sacrifice. And we really appreciate the time you've given us.
Great. Thank you very much.